wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Kia ora, Alan.
Hey, Nicholas. Hey, Lou.
How are you?
Oh, I'm here. I'm good. It's November. It's nearly the end of the year, and it's scary. And it's November the 7th.
Ooh.
So what's so big about November the 7th?
Oof. I feel like I'm failing class here. Did I forget? Is it our anniversary, Alan?
No. It is the birthday of three extraordinary women.
Oh, yeah.
Three utterly extraordinary women. Number one, Marie Curie, of whom you've all heard.
Yes.
Of course, yes.
Still the first and only person to win a Nobel Prize in physics and chemistry.
That's pretty incredible. I did not know that.
I didn't know that either. That's really
first,
cool.
First person to win two Nobel Prizes.
Jeez.
Wow. Yep. She is amazing. Lisa Meitner. She discovered nuclear fission.
Amazing.
Okay. Is that
the bonding of...
It's when uranium splits apart and gives you atomic bombs and stuff
the
like that.
Opposite of bonding.
Indeed, fission, complete.
Yeah. Didn't listen to the fission part. I was just like, nuclear, yeah. Nuclear.
And she discovered this just before World War II. She was a Jewish scientist in Germany, and so she had to get the hell out of there, obviously.
Mm.
One of her co-workers got the Nobel Prize for this discovery.
Classic.
She didn't, but she is on the periodic table. Only two women are on the periodic table, and they're both born on the same day.
That's incredible.
Really cool.
That is incredible. Something special about November 7th.
Marie Curie, Lisa Meitner, and Joni Mitchell is 80 today.
Oh, we love Joni Mitchell.
We love Joni Mitchell. Yes. There we go.
It is a good day. Yeah. Who would have thought November 7th?
But anyway, let's talk science.
Yes.
And let's start off with Shakespeare.
Shakespeare?
Yes. Oh, yes, indeed. You know, what's in a name? That which we call a rose by any other name would smell as sweet.
Mm. Beautiful.
Okay. So, makes perfect sense, you know, when you get to about my age, you sort of figure it all out. You read Shakespeare when you're at high school and it just makes no sense whatsoever. Anyway, so how do we go about naming things in science or just in general, you know, because we've got this entire living world out there. And so you sort of think back to, you know, a couple of millennia ago and people are seeing all of these animals, all these plants and everything. And, you know, what do they call them? Bob, Henry, Sue, you know, they can't do that. They've got to come up with some sort of naming scheme, which is why I guess sort of the naming schemes that are in vogue tend to be derived from Greek and Latin.
Yes.
Around that time. And then there was a guy by the name of Carl Linnaeus, who in the 1700s, he was a Swedish guy, and he realized, okay, we do have a problem here. We've got so many different types of plants, so many different types of animals. We're going to have to come up with some sort of systematic naming system whereby we can name everything and give them a unique name.
Hmm.
So he came up with this idea of a double name. Where he talks about the genus and the species, and there's a whole lot of other things, there's families and all that sort of stuff, this higher level stuff, but this sort of uniquely defines things. So we have got a double name, and again, mostly derived from Latin and the Greek.
Yep.
And so, for example, we talk about, and so it goes genus and then species. So we talk about the domestic dog, and the domestic dog is Canis lupus.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Canis is the genus, and so that means all sorts of dogs or wild dogs, dingoes, wolves, all those sort of things, as well as domestic. And then the lupus bit means the domestic dog. And ironically, lupus comes from the Latin for wolf.
Wasn't it? And there was like a tale about, I think it was a Greek myth about a person named Lupus or Lupin, and they had an affinity for wolves or was raised by wolves or something like that.
Professor Lupin?
No, there's like, the name has origins from the Greek myth. Yeah, it was just Harry Potter. I just had a dream about it.
Really good classic piece of literature right there.
I'm going to go back and research this, and next time I'm going to be like, this one.
So, domestic dog Canis lupus, big old dinosaur Tyrannosaurus rex, the king of the tyrant lizards.
Wow,
Tyrannosaurus.
That is amazing.
Oh, my
okay, Rex King from, is that Greek or Latin? That's from Latin. And then the Greek is Tyrannosaurus, tyrant lizard. So King of the tyrant lizards. There you go. And So basically, he introduced this naming system, and this has all gone great over the past sort of 300 or so years. Except that some people have been sort of, let's say, naming things after things or people that perhaps they possibly shouldn't have been, okay? And it's estimated now that around about 20% of all the animals are named after somebody. Which is
That's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's about 1.5 million animals that are classified like this, and so they're named after people. So, for example, there is a horsefly that Lou just pulled up on screen before, and this horsefly is called Escaptia Beyoncei. Okay?
What?
And it is named after, obviously, Beyonce Knowles. There is a crustacean called Leucothoi eltoni, which is named after Elton John.
It's amazing.
Obviously.
Who chose the crustacean? That is...
obviously a fan.
Yeah.
And there is also a spider that is called Anolosimus Big Lebowski.
What? That is insane. So,
obviously a fan of that particular movie, and who isn't? The Dude
yeah,
Abides.
Great.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, and in 2017, this is the best. So in 2017, they had a new moth. And this particular moth had pale blonde head scales and very small genitalia. So they named it Neopalpa Donald Trump Eye.
No.
Brutal.
Very small.
So that's quite funny, depending or not, depending on which side of the political fence you're on. But in 1937, somebody discovered a brown eyeless beetle in a cave in Slovenia. And they decided to call this beetle Anophthalmos Hitleri.
What?
Yes, you heard it. Yes.
That is insane.
So, and there was also a butterfly discovered in Libya around about the same time, and they called that Hypopter Mussolini Eye.
Mm.
So this is pre-World War II, just before it starts.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
That is incredible.
Now, believe it or not, so this beetle in Slovenia, we've got a whole bunch of neo-Nazis who want this beetle, and so they're all after specimens of this beetle, and it's basically pushing it towards extinction.
Wow.
There's that many neo-Nazis out there, sadly. Unfortunately. So you can see a problem here, can't you?
Yes.
You can see a problem. Yes. So there is a big argument currently at the International Commission on Zoological Nomenclature.
Amazing name.
Yeah.
Nomenclature.
Right. So the question then becomes, should we be naming or should we be continuing to name things after people who've got slightly dodgy pasts, to put it mildly, okay? So this question had come up, and in January, basically the head of this bunch of folks said that, no, we can't go changing things because that's just going to cause confusion.
Mm.
All sorts of problems. We need stability above all. And so they put that out in an editorial in their magazine. And so just recently, the past couple of months, has been some more editorials basically taking the opposing view, saying that, no, you know, this just doesn't make any sense at all. We need to sort this out. And so what is going to happen is that next year, in July 2024, so they're going to have an international botanical congress. That is going to be held in Madrid next year. And they're going to have a vote, basically, about what to do about this. Now, the American Ornithological Society, all about birds, they have grasped the nettle, as it were, and they have said, right, we're going to change the name of some common American birds because they were named after racist, misogynists, etc., etc., etc. And so the other option, or the option that people are now putting out there, is, right, let's just stop naming things after people. Because it's getting a touch ridiculous. I mean, the Donald Trump eye is funny the first time you hear it, but you know.
Yeah.
Having to put that in a paper is going to be...
It's hard to take it seriously.
Yes, just a little. But so, you know, this is a big thing at the moment, actually. So all sorts of arguments going on there. And you know, I can see both sides in them, really.
Yeah, 100%.
As a scientist. And it'll be very, very interesting to see how this goes. How this will be the most eagerly awaited vote since they voted Pluto out of being a planet.
Ooh.
I know. I still disagree with that.
It's incredible the lengths we go to as human beings to put labels on things. They
Yep.
this whole big kerfuffle, and this beetle is probably chilling in the cave, not even
keeping out of the way of neo-Nazis. Yeah. So,
my name is Bob, not like, you know, like,
Bob the beetle.
My government name is, yeah. What are you talking about? What do you have up next for us, Alan?
So we're going to talk water now. We're going to talk water, and we are going to talk about how do you turn liquid water into gaseous water? There we go. How do you turn it into water vapor?
Heat it.
Evaporation. Yes. How do you evaporate it?
Heat it.
Yeah. Like boiling.
Boiling. Yep. Get it boiling.
Get it boiling, and it goes. Yep. It goes below boiling as well, doesn't it?
Mm. Yes.
Yes, it does. As I always tell my first years, to general amazement, look at the puddles of water after the rain. And where does the water go? It doesn't boil away, does it? It evaporates. And it evaporates, as we think, or as we thought, let's say, due solely to the fact that it is warming up. And what happens is that as it warms up, the water molecules get a little bit more energetic. And when they get up to the surface, essentially, the water, some of them then get the requisite energy that they can basically bounce their way out of the water up into the vapor phase above the liquid. And that's what we sort of think of when we think of evaporation, that it's a process that requires an input of heat.
Yes.
However, a bunch of folk at MIT, not the Manukau one, the Massachusetts one. And so what they have found now is that simply shining light on water seems to get it to evaporate without an input of heat.
What? And what kind of lights are they shining on?
That's a very good question. Normal, just bog standard basic light. And what they did, they started this work off when some other workers, they had water in a thing called a hydrogel. A hydrogel is just a polymer that holds a lot of water, sort of like a sponge sort of thing, a molecular sponge, you could call it, something like that. And they were finding some weird results with this. So these guys went and checked all of this, and they know what the evaporation rate should be if it's just heat doing it.
Yeah.
And they found that the evaporation rate was significantly higher than it should be just from the fact that, if it was only heat being accounted for. So something else is going on here.
Yeah.
And so they had a wee think, and then said, it might be the light doing it. So they did some experiments where they're just shining normal light on the surface of this hydrogel impregnated with water. And again, they're finding much, much higher rates of evaporation than should happen if it was just only heat that was doing this.
Incredible.
And so then they started looking into it more and everything, and they found that it was color dependent. So if you shine green light on the water, it would evaporate more rapidly than for any other color of light.
Wow.
So
that's so fascinating.
So that was saying that it's definitely the light. It's not just, it's nothing to do with the heat in this case, it's the light. Okay.
So if I'm boiling past the water, should I turn on the light above the stove? Does it make it go faster?
Well, no. That's a good question. So they sort of started thinking, right, how can this possibly work? What's going on here? And they thought back to an old experiment of Einstein, a thing called the photoelectric effect, where if you shine light on a piece of metal, you can kick electrons off the piece of metal. And that led to the whole idea of photons, of light being a particle as well as a wave at the same time.
Yes.
Because these little particles would hit the surface of the metal and then pop off an electron. So they're thinking the same sort of thing works here, is that you've got these photons that are hitting the surface of the water, getting a bunch of water molecules and basically booting them out of the water into the gas phase.
Yeah.
Okay. And you're all sitting there listening to this and think, so what? Whoop-de-doo, just typical bloody, academic, of no interest to anybody. But turns out that water is a potent greenhouse gas. Okay.
What?
It is. Oh, it absolutely is. Yes. So we think of CO2, we think of carbon dioxide and methane as being the nasty greenhouse gases. Water is also there as well, and obviously water is kind of an important component part of
of
the atmosphere. Yeah.
Just a little bit. Yeah.
So the question of how much water have we got in the atmosphere, and how does it get there? So it might be that when we're doing climate modelling and sort of looking at climate change and everything, they are now saying that we're going to get a lot more water in the atmosphere than we would normally have thought, because of the just we think it's all to do with heat, but seemingly it's not. So it's going to be the light that's doing it as well. So we're going to get increased amounts of water in the atmosphere, and that's going to be taken account of in any sort of climate change modeling. And what they're really interested in now is getting rid of or desalination, basically. So we're all about solar powered desalination plants, okay? Yep. Because that's the way to make clean water in desert parts of the world. And now they're thinking, well, you know, you can basically get a lot more evaporation if you shine light on the water as well. And they're thinking like 3 to 4 times as much evaporation as you can get just from merely heating it up. So this, you know, is going to be way more energy efficient.
Yeah.
And, you know, quite remarkable. So just this sort of chance observation, I guess, that people made. And, you know, that's the way of all science, really, you know.
Major implications.
You get lucky and, yeah. So there
Shout
we go.
Shout out to MIT.
Absolutely.
Yes. Massachusetts. Yeah.
And Monaco.
And just very, very quickly, finally, seeing as on the subject of water, some scientists in Finland have made the world's most water-resistant surface.
Incredible.
Okay, so water just basically slides off, okay? And you're sort of thinking, well, you know, what's the big thing about water resistance? Well, it's important in things like cooking, transportation, optics, plumbing, things like de-icing, anti-fogging, anywhere that you don't want water, you know. So water resistance is very, very important. So what they've done very, very quickly, they've made this solid surface that they put a really, 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 really thin, one atom thin liquid layer over, okay, called self-assembled monolayer, it's called. And they're basically covering a silicon surface with this stuff, and they find that basically the water just slides right off. And so this is officially the slipperiest. The slipperiest known surface really known in science. So
that is incredible.
Yeah. And again, you might think, well, you know, why do people do this? But, you know, there are applications out there, and why people ultimately do it is because we're learning more about the world in which we live, which is kind of important.
Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that what we're doing here?
Absolutely.
Well, thank you to science. Thank you to Alan.
Thank you, Alan.
And most importantly, not most importantly, but very importantly, thank you to MoTeC.
Amen. Thank you.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MoTeC, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.